May it please the Court, Nicole Walker on behalf of the appellant Stephen Drake. The two issues before the Court today, and the first one deals with Mr. Drake's rights to self-representation. On March 13, 2006, the trial court had a hearing addressing Mr. Weiler's motion to withdraw as counsel based on threats that had been made to him by his client. The trial court not only granted that motion, but the court also addressed Mr. Drake's request to represent himself. The court had presented him with the option of either staying with Mr. Weiler, hiring a private attorney, or representing himself. He indicated he wanted to represent himself. So the court engaged in the proper colloquy as required in Zubo versus State and other cases by this court. She determined that he was alert and intelligent, understood the rules, that he would have to follow the rules. He understood that there was inherent risks in representing himself. She then found that he knowingly, intelligently, and voluntarily waived his right to counsel. Subsequently, on March 21st...
Can I stop you there, yes. Ms. Walker? There was a successive judge.
That's correct.
Is the successor judge bound by that first ruling? If the successor judge, perceives that, whatever the status may have been earlier on, it may no longer be.
Right. No, I don't believe she is. And actually, to some degree, this is similar to Ferrato, where the court, if she finds on the day of trial that he wants to then invoke his right to counsel, I believe she has discretion then to address that.
Isn't that what happened here?
Not necessarily. She did exercise her discretion in raising the issue, but unfortunately the process by which she engaged in the discussion wasn't sufficient enough then to determine whether he then waived his right to represent himself.
Okay, so the court didn't err in revisiting the issue?
No.
Your argument is that the court erred because it came out the wrong way?
Correct, and was handled the wrong way.
And precisely why?
Because she did not, again, when the successor judge raised the issue, she said, look, I'm concerned about this, what's going on here, and he says, I want to represent myself. I want to present evidence the way I want to, not the way my attorney wants to. I want to present my case the way I want to. And she said, well, I'm afraid you're not going to get a fair trial. Can you apologize to Mr. Weiler? And at first he said, no, I'm not going to.
Well, can you dispel for me the thinking that as the new Superior Court judge comes on the bench, the law of the case doctrine does or does not apply first to the ruling by her co-equal Superior Court judge? Why she should go any further than accepting that as a ruling, other than if the defendant initiates a request,
right,
that I no longer want to represent myself, I want an attorney. Dispel from my thoughts that this trial judge simply did not want to deal with a pro se defendant and wanted a lawyer there because life would be easier.
I can't do that. I think that the court is correct in saying if the defendant had raised the issue, then I do think she would have discretion to address it. But he didn't do that. And she was, it appears from the record, concerned about the process by which she would have to go through dealing with a pro se defendant.
Well, did not your client acquiesce ultimately and say by words or conduct, when he was specifically asked after this so-called reconciliation, are you okay with this?
Mm-hmm.
And he said he just wanted a fair trial. What if he truly wanted to self-represent himself? Why wouldn't he say, no, I want to represent myself?
Well, asking a defendant, are you okay with this, is significantly different than engaging in a proper colloquy. He had already waived his right to counsel. Now we're talking about waiving your right to self-representation, which is where he was. She had initially discussed with him, could you please at least consider having standby counsel? Then she sent him downstairs to apologize to Mr. Weiler. When he came back up, Mr. Weiler told the court, I think he wants to go forward with counsel. He had a discussion with the trial court. Mr. Chernov also chimed in, and then the question was asked, are you okay with this?
Ms. Walker, if we were to rule the way you're arguing, any ruling would have to be expressed in terms of a rule of law. What would the rule of law be here?
It would be that he was violated with his right to self-representation under Ferret.
That's the ultimate bottom line, but that's a conclusion.
Correct. That she did not engage in the proper colloquy here for him to waive his right to represent himself.
Namely?
Namely, she did not go through determining, well, you have the right to represent yourself, which you've already asserted. Do you understand by going through representing by counsel, you have to defer to your counsel for things such as strategic decisions, et cetera? And she didn't do any of that.
Well, if I had to write anything, I would want to know the answer to the question, what are the conditions under which a Superior Court judge may reassess an earlier determination by a Superior Court judge that a defendant has exercised his or her right to self-representation?
I think that is, the court makes a good point about the rule of the case. I do think that there would be certain circumstances whereas if he raised the issue again where she could discuss it with him. However, if she could address it with him again, and unless there's something significant to be brought to her attention, I would argue that she should defer to the previous ruling.
One of the reasons I think Justice Jacobs wants to get a firm handle around this is, what if the trial judge here had followed my suggestion and thought that the rule of the case, the law of the case, was that this defendant has a right to represent himself and has opted to exercise that right knowingly, willingly, and intelligibly? Then the trial begins, and it's a disaster. It's clear he doesn't know what he's doing and doesn't understand. Would that be a point in time when the second judge could intervene and say, let's reassess that now? It's evident to me that there are some difficulties with you representing yourself. Do you genuinely want to consider? What kind of parameters do we put on this? Is there a bright line rule or not?
I don't think there is a bright line rule with respect to this. What keeps coming to my mind is the issue with respect to competency and how that can change from day to day. This is a little different when you're dealing with a defendant, though, who's not completely aware of all the rules, and even though he may acknowledge that he understands the inherent risks, circumstances could change. For example, in this case, before the subsequent hearing, he had received discovery from the state himself. He reviewed it himself. He was preparing the case himself. Had he looked at that and came to the court and said, look, I see all this evidence. I can't deal with this. I don't know that I can handle that. That may very well be an opportunity for the court to reconsider it, which would be along the lines of what you're saying with respect to actually at trial. And I think that would also depend on the facts of the case.
Couldn't the mere passage of time be a reason to for the judge, whether it's the original judge or the successor judge, to want to reassure himself or herself that this defendant is knowingly and intelligently waiving the right to counsel?
I could understand why the court would want to reassure itself, because it is a different judge, and the passage of time could deal with that. But even if that were the case, that's not the situation here. He came in after having reviewed evidence on his own and said, I want to present my case. I want to question my witnesses. And she continued to say, well, I don't think you're going to get a fair trial unless you have an attorney. And she tried to convince him to have standby counsel. And it was only after the defendant left the courtroom that she told Mr. Chernev, I want Mr. Weiler to represent him. So going into that, there's a clearness, there could have been a misunderstanding on his part as to what the role of Mr. Weiler would be when he was downstairs talking with Mr. Weiler. And again, when the court subsequently says, are you okay with that, that just doesn't satisfy what is necessary to then waive his right to self-representation.
I think this is implicit in the briefs, but I just want to make sure. Your side is not claiming that there were any specific prejudice as a result of the defendant's right to self-representation being violated. Is that correct?
That's correct. As the court is aware, harmless error standard does not apply when dealing right. with self-representation issues.
Indeed, in many of these cases, there may be more prejudice as a result of the self-representation than as a result of being represented by counsel.
That may very well be true. And as the United States Supreme Court has acknowledged in Ferretta, just because someone may do more harm to themselves doesn't mean they don't have the right to represent themselves. And it's the defendant that has all these rights, not his attorney. So he's the one that if he wants to represent his cause his way, he's entitled to do that.
Can you comment and help me with this language? I mean, I'm going to quote to you language from this court in Walker versus State. It was decided February 15 by this panel. The right to self-representation is not unqualified, however, and may be waived more easily than the right to counsel. Moreover, a defendant may waive the right to self-representation after asserting it. Waiver may be established by a defendant's failure to reassert the request if it would not be futile to do so. So what was not done that should have been done? If there's a lesser standard that you don't have to go through all of this colloquy when you're waiving counsel, and you can even waive self-representation by being quiet, why isn't that what happened here? Are you okay with this? And he did not say no.
A couple of reasons. First, he was under the impression when he left the courtroom that he was going to be appointed standby counsel, not representation officially by counsel. Secondly, there was a significant discussion with him where he repeatedly told the court, I want to present the case my way. It wasn't a matter of being
and
silent.
At what point, was that in the trial itself?
No, this was at the hearing. He did again at trial. But at this point, he said to the court, she said, well, why, you know, if you represent yourself, I'm concerned you're not going to be able to do this. And he said, well, you know, Judge Johnston told me that if I didn't want Mr. Weiler, I had to either hire private counsel or represent myself. So I chose to represent myself because I want to present the case the way I want to. I want to call the witnesses that I want to. I want to challenge the evidence the way I want to. Then she said, well, why don't you go downstairs and apologize to Mr. Weiler? And that's when they made amends, and Mr. Weiler came up and said, I think he wants counsel. And then Mr. Weiler went off into, we need to have this case continued.
Well, does the defendant then have, if that's wrong, doesn't the defendant have an obligation to speak up? He was there when Mr. Weiler said that?
Yes.
Does he have an obligation to speak up and say, that's wrong, I do want to represent myself still?
Well, I think if assuming he understood what was being said there with respect to is he just going to be standby counsel versus my full attorney, what does that mean? He's having his appearance entered on the record. And if he hadn't said anything to indicate otherwise before the apology, then I would say you're probably right that in that particular case, his silence was a waiver.
Let's change the facts somewhat. Assume that there was no prior determination by a first judge that there had been a proper waiver of the right to counsel. With all the other facts remaining the same, would your position be different?
If he had not previously waived his right to counsel, then I would suppose that her determination would be fine. Because there wouldn't be, she would have questioned him. First of all, I don't think there would have been the hearing. I think that if she would have questioned him if he raised the issue that I want to represent myself, and then she would have gone through the colloquy at that time with respect to waiving counsel. Is that
No, that's not what I'm asking.
Okay.
Let's assume that whatever colloquy they went through the second time around is the colloquy.
Okay.
But there was no prior determination through some earlier colloquy that Mr. Drake intended to and competently did waive his right to counsel.
In that case, I think there would be some question as to whether it was an equivocal assertion of his right to counsel. I think if the court's going by the actual facts of the March 21st hearing, there's still that issue of the standby counsel if that was raised.
Okay, so you agree that the determination that was made by the earlier judge is not law of the case. But yet it has some legal force that would not exist if that hearing hadn't been made. I mean, if that determination hadn't been made.
Well, what I'm saying is that just because the prior colloquy occurred does not mean she cannot readdress it. And what I'm saying is it turns on his constitutional rights. If he waived his right, he waived his right. He can always, I suppose, change his mind. Now, whether or not he was allowed to, then waive his right to self-representation is what we're here for.
So you're saying if he waived it the first time, then it continues to be waived
throughout.
That's pretty much law of the case, isn't it?
Yes, I guess that's correct. I think I said that incorrectly before.
Did you want to save the balance?
Yes, thank you.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. If it pleases the Court, I don't think it's any secret that trial judges feel whipsawed by Feretta. I mean, they're in the damned if you do and the damned if you don't situation. If you let the defendant go pro se, then he'll later on appeal or in Rule 61 or at some point claim that he was denied his right to counsel. If you give him counsel, later claim that he was denied his Feretta rights. And the judges here, especially Judge Del Pesco, the trial judge, I think took pains and properly did on the morning that trial was scheduled to go forward to ask Mr. Drake whether he really, truly wanted to assert his right to represent himself. And
when do you cross the line between explaining risks and exerting pressure? Or is it okay to exert pressure?
I don't think Judge Del Pesco did, but to answer the Court's question, I think a little pressure might not be a bad idea, because it's no secret the defendant is doing himself no favor by representing himself. And when your answer is on A21, and the question is, now the reason, Judge Del Pesco, now the reason I am concerned is that you have refused counsel, is that correct? And then the defendant, as he goes on, tells the story. At the end, he said, and that's what I did, so I came to court 2 weeks ago, and they told me I had to come by myself. Now, that is not exactly a ringing affirmation of a defendant's desire to go and represent himself. It's they told me I had to come by myself.
Well, if I understand this Walker's position correctly, it is at that point that Judge Del Pesco should have gone through the litany of questions in order to determine in a proper way, all over again, whether indeed this defendant wanted to waive his right to counsel or waive his right to self-representation, whatever might be the case.
Well, before the judge gets to the colloquy, the standard colloquy, the judge has to have at least some statement on the part of the defendant that he wishes to exercise his right to self-representation. And Judge Del Pesco, in this case, wanted to make sure of that. Because Judge Del Pesco was not the judge who previously granted Mr. Weiler's motion to withdraw, which is what that was about. This was the trial judge and wanted to assure for herself that he wanted, not that he didn't understand the risks of going forward. Judge Johnston earlier had gone through the colloquy and determined that Mr. Drake met the minimum qualification of going pro se, which is not much. You just understand that, you know, you're hanging yourself, basically, and you're going to be expected to comport yourself in a proper manner and follow the rules, even if you don't know what the rules are.
Again, the argument that we're confronting here is that once there, even if there has been a prior determination that the defendant has competently waived the right to counsel, if the question resurfaces as a result of another judge being appointed, that judge and the evidence is perhaps ambiguous. It could go either way. Then the judge must engage in a proper colloquy to determine very pointedly whether or not this defendant wants to represent himself or be represented.
And the argument is
there was no such colloquy here.
Oh, I think there was. I think Judge Del Pesco went through the proper colloquy in this case, which was to determine in the first instance whether the defendant even wanted to go forward, even before we get to do you understand, you know, what you're getting yourself into questions.
Wasn't that clear? He wanted to represent himself at the outset, and then there was this discussion about if you want a fair trial, the way you get a fair trial is have an attorney. And what does that imply?
Well, if that happens in a... I'm sorry.
Isn't that what happened here?
Oh, no.
Now, how do I help you get a fair trial? And I'm telling you, the best way is for you to have the benefit of counsel. So what does that mean, that he's not going to be able to cross-examine witnesses unless he has counsel, that he can't subpoena witnesses for his defense?
No, I think the judge is being accurate in saying the best way for you to get a fair trial is to have a competent attorney represent you and not try to do this yourself. Just like a auto mechanic would say to a fellow, well, the best way for you to get a good tune-up on your car is have the mechanic do it and not do it yourself. You know, if you want to do this, it's no secret that Mr. Drake was facing some serious charges here.
The error that's being argued by defense counsel is that the second judge, the trial judge, did not engage in a proper colloquy to determine whether or not the right to self-representation was being waived. Your response, as I understand it, is yes, she did.
Yes.
Engage in a proper colloquy. So that's the issue before us. That's the only issue as you see it.
Yes. And I think, first of all...
Well, before you go further, I took it also, because I made a note of it, your citation to the record where the defendant said they told me I had to come by myself was at least a suggestion that he might be having second thoughts about self-representation.
No, I agree.
Which arguably would trigger the inquiry that Judge Del Pesco made.
Definitely. I mean, Judge Del Pesco, I think, was rightfully skeptical at hearing that to probe further into Mr. Drake's true desires here. And those desires were not.
So if I had asked you the same question that I asked Ms. Walker, your response would have been, there was a trigger here. Yes, there needs to be a trigger, and there was one here. There was some basis for the second trial judge to believe he was having second thoughts about self-representation.
Oh, I certainly think that. I don't know that I'm not suggesting that a trigger is absolutely needed. I mean, there certainly was one in this case. But again, what I said to begin, the trial judges very often feel whipsawed by this. You know, they are in a very tough position, a damned if you don't, damned if you do situation.
What kind of colloquy, in your view, is sufficient? Is it enough to say, are you okay with Mr. Weiler representing you now?
After they've had their conversation and everybody, they seem to have kissed and made up.
Is that enough?
That's enough. If the defendant says that I'm satisfied, I've talked to Mr. Weiler, and I'm satisfied, I want him to represent me. That's his invocation of his right to counsel. That's sort of the default. The Faretta right is not
To follow up on Justice Ridgely's question, does the judge have to go further and say, you understand, do you not, Mr. Drake, that you will not be able to question witnesses? That will be up to your counsel. That you won't be able to cross-examine, that is for your counsel to do. That type of question. That is getting more into the actual details and consequences of having a lawyer act on
Not the responsibility of the trial judge. And, in fact, that's the responsibility of counsel. That's something for counsel and defense, for defense counsel and his client to work out exactly how much say he's going to have over this.
Is there any case law guidance on the script, so to speak, that a judge is supposed to engage in questioning a defendant in an effort to determine whether or not there has been or has not been a waiver of the right to self-representation?
No, there is not. There's no, when someone says, yes, I would like a lawyer, one does not go through and first make sure that the individual knows that he's waiving his very sacred Faretta right to self-representation. No, you give him a lawyer. And then if he has any questions about how this case is going to be presented, he can talk to his lawyer about it. That's what they're there for. No, there is no colloquy to giving up one's Faretta right to represent self-representation.
No Miranda-type questioning.
No. If you understand your appointed attorney is appointed to you, you will have no say in how your case is presented. No, you don't. Oh, that's all right. because that may be incorrect. I mean, the lawyer, a particular lawyer, may be very, very apt to accede to a client's wishes. Okay, well, I don't think it's the best way, but I'll do it your way. You know, I mean, that's between them, basically. It's not for the judge to decide. My bottom line is here that I think, first of all, Judge Del Pesco was perfectly within her discretion here and acted admirably in making sure that Mr. Drake really understood what he was getting himself into and getting his very equivocal answer that they told me I had to come by myself. Went into it further. I certainly don't think the defendant here was denied his Faretta rights because he never really unequivocally asserted them. He just said, I want a fair trial. I want a fair trial. You know, he's sort of being petulant. Okay, well, if you won't give me a new lawyer, well, I'll just do it myself. Realize that nobody addressed the argument two. Just briefly, I suppose when Judge Roy Bean was the law west of the Pecos, something like this would fly. But here, I mean, the courts just don't condone violent behavior. There's no claim of right defense, anything like this. And I note that in Belinsky, for example, one of the two cases, this court has addressed it, the other one being Wright, which was a pure theft of services. In Belinsky, where there was a threat, an attempted extortion case where Belinsky went and threatened to blow up the bank unless they gave him his money that he thought they had stolen from the safety deposit box. The trial judge, I think it was a bench trial, the trial judge found, I'll accept your claim of right defense for the extortion, but I'm going to find you guilty of terroristic threatening for making these threats anyhow. So he did not get away with, Mr. Belinsky did not get away with his terroristic violent type behavior. He was found guilty of that. Certainly in this case where we're dealing with robberies and burglaries and rapes, that whatever basis there was in the evidence for that defense. And
the evidence here was essentially a home invasion to collect drug money.
That was the argument. I'm not quite sure where that comes in the record. He claimed he didn't do it. I mean, he testified. Mr. Drake testified and claimed he didn't do it. He was out smoking dope with Mr. Nordmeyer in the backyard when the police arrived and arrested him. That was his defense.
My understanding is that the judge found that defense wouldn't fly because it was against public policy, at least in these circumstances. It would be against public policy, to ground a claim of right defense on a criminal act, particularly an act of violence. The other side argues that that's precisely what the case law does allow. And, of course, since that came up in the reply brief, you've had no chance to respond to it. But what is your response?
I think probably the best case is that Jupiter case I cited, which is a nice survey of the law as of the time Jupiter was decided, which was not too long ago. And really, the claim of right defense is being chipped away at more and more and more. And the Maryland Court of Appeals notes that, A, when violence is involved, you know, it goes out the window, and B, when the violence or the claim of right is to an illegal debt, as was the case here, it goes out the window. So you can't resort to criminal behavior to recover an illegal debt, and you can't resort to it if you resort to violence, and which is exactly what the Belinsky case is, where this court approved terroristic threatening as a lesser included offense of extortion, of attempted extortion. Because, you know, convicting him of the violent
act. If it's a defense, it's not criminal behavior, right?
I'm sorry?
If it is truly a defense, it's not criminal behavior.
Yes. In the Wright case, which was theft of services, rehooking your electric up after the power company had turned it off because the defendant, Mr. Wright, in that case, claimed that there was a billing dispute and that he was owed the power. And this court said that the judge disallowed the defense or disallowed the testimony that would establish the defense. And this court said, well, he should have been able to establish it. There was no violence there. No violence involved. There was no illegal debt. Mr. Wright thought that he was owed the power and that the power company had unjustifiably turned it off, and so he hooked it back up again. So in that kind of case would be allowable. But when we get into crimes against people,
Your argument is that if this defendant had attempted to recover this drug money in a civil action, say for breach of contract, he certainly could not do that.
No, he could not do that.
And if he could not do that as a civil matter, then he certainly could not predicate a defense to a criminal charge upon the same conduct.
The basic rule there is that illegal debts are non-recoverable.
Well, it's not a right that he can claim.
No, not a right that the courts or, excuse me, the law should, recognize. One does not do one's money due to a bad drug deal. That should be obvious. If the court has no further questions.
Just a couple points. First, with respect to self-representation, Judge Johnston at the first hearing told Mr. Drake that he had the option of hiring a private attorney representing himself or going with the public defender that he had, and that's an accurate statement of the position, and that's at A15 through A16. There was an unequivocal waiver of his rights. The prosecutor understood that. He told Judge Del Pesca that. Both judges understood that, and the client understood that.
Can you tell us what colloquy is constitutionally required?
There is a bright line colloquy. The point in this particular case is based on the facts of this case, the court was required to do something beyond asking, are you okay with that? While the court's prior holding is correct, what the circumstances of this case isn't somebody who was just quiet. That same day, 10 minutes, if that, before she asked that question, he says, I want to represent my case the way I want to represent it. So there had to be some type of discussion with him regarding, you're not going to necessarily, now whether Mr. Weiler defers to him or not is between them, but he's not necessarily going to have that right.
So are you saying no particular colloquy is required, but there is an abuse of discretion by not going further in this case?
What the problem is here is that someone's constitutional right is at issue. It's beyond abuse of discretion.
But is there a case that tells us what the colloquy is? And if not, what are you suggesting the colloquy should be?
The right to self-representation is the corollary to the right to counsel. Thus, I would argue that the cases in Zuppo and Briscoe that this court has addressed and established a script for the waiver of the right to counsel should apply. Explaining the risks, explaining the reality, explaining to him a situation like you're not going to be able to necessarily cross-examine unless you and your attorney decide to do that. And I think that is where the potential colloquy comes from. If the court doesn't want to find that that's necessary all the time, the facts of this case dictate that it be done in this case. With respect to the claim of right argument, it all boils down to one thing, and that's Zimmerman. This court has held in 1993 in Zimmerman and prior to that in two previous cases that the plain language of the claim of right defense controls. The policy reasons to the contrary do not control. That case in Zimmerman was done in 1993. Since that time, the legislature has not touched the statute. Thus, if this court were to rule the way the state wants the court to rule, that would be judicial legislation because the court has said the plain language is the plain language.
Is it your position that under the Delaware law today, home invasions to collect a drug debt are lawful?
Yes, because Superior Court Judge, I believe Hurley, he noted that in Barksdale versus State that in that case it was also a burglary involving a drug debt, and he said the claim of right defense applies. What he noted, which I think is correct, is that the circumstances, the facts, are for the jury to decide, and they may undermine the defense, and very likely would undermine the defense, but he still has the right to have that asserted. And as Mr. Donovan...
There's no dispute that if we adopted that as Delaware law, it would more likely than not encourage home invasions for that personal purpose than discourage them, correct?
That's possible. And again, as the state put forth in Zimmerman, the court noted this is a sound policy reason against this claim of right defense, but that's not what the plain language says. And if this court doesn't follow Zimmerman in the prior cases, it is engaging in judicial legislation. It's determining, you know, that legislature hasn't done anything about this now yet, so we need to discourage this. And that's just not appropriate.
There's a difference between concluding from legislative history that the legislature has thought about it and decided not to change it, and looking at a legislative history that suggests absolutely nothing about whether the legislature even thought about this wrinkle or not, isn't there?
There is, but I think the fact that this policy reasoning was raised in Zimmerman and was addressed in Zimmerman is clear that the issue has been out there. So whether or not they've considered it, I think it's more likely than not that they've had that opportunity. So I think that is compelling.
I know they yearn to read our cases, so you may be
Thank you.
Thank you very much, counsel. We'll take the case under advisement and adjourn.